So, again, it's the April 2nd. It's the second half of the semester. Chapter 17, Financial Statements and Ratio Analysis. Today, we passed them out. We're going to have exam number 3 next Thursday. We went over the exam. It's not on tape. Not being recorded. But we're going to re-ask you. I ask you again. The stuff from Chapter 5 that was on exam number 2. This constant perpetual growth model. The discounted cash flow model. Plus the ratio analysis we're going to start today. Finish up on Thursday. And so be prepared. Be prepared. And we're going to ask you the constant perpetual growth model on exam number 4. And on the final exam. And you're not leaving Business 123 without learning how to do this. Okay, so we're ready. Everybody got chapter 17? Oh, I'm sorry. Where is it? Here it is. Pass this that way. Oops. But first we need a good joke. Anybody have a good joke? Oh, that's just taking me. Sorry. Did I tell you about a Juan in a mall? See, we're no more bar jokes now. Okay. No, I didn't tell you about Juan in a mall. Oh, right, dude. Well, see, what happened is this woman was very young, and she got pregnant, and she couldn't keep the baby. She had twins, Juan and Amal. And they were adopted by a family. And years later, she has her own family now, husband, she's happily married, has her own kids. She gets a call from Juan, who wants to meet her. And she's so excited. She hops on a plane, flies to the family where Juan has his own kids now, and it's such a wonderful reunion, and she's just so ecstatic. So she comes back, and her husband picks her up at the airport, and she's sad. What happened? Oh, it's so great seeing Juan, but now I want to see my other son. And her husband said, "Don't worry, dear, don't fret. Once you've seen Juan, you've seen them all." You're going to go back to the bar jokes? All right. So that was that's chapter. I know it's the second book of this thing. Now, any accounting students in here? Accounting students. You don't sound excited. Okay, don't worry. We're not going to create any financial statements. We're just going to use them, dear students. You do not have to create the financial statements. We are just going to use them. They're already done for you, right? And so we're going to just do ratio analysis. And the reason we spend a little bit of time, more than I probably would have if I were just designing this, is because of Mr. Benjamin Graham. Mr. Benjamin Graham, who was Warren Buffett's teacher, don't read the first book, but when you read The Intelligent Investor, you're going to see that he uses financial ratios quite a bit. He really, really hammers away that you should be looking at these ratios. And who am I to argue with Mr. Benjamin Graham? So, those of you who have had accounting or are taking accounting, this is going to be a lot of review. This is not going to be that difficult. So you have a leg up. You already have, because you understand these things better than the vast majority of us. I took accounting a million years ago. I actually did well. I got A's in both classes. And after I left my second class, I said, I ain't never doing that again. Unless somebody puts a really big stack of $100 bills in front of me. I had nothing to do with that. And I haven't. So the balance sheet, right? Assets, liabilities. Now, why did they call it a balance sheet? Because in the olden days, before computers and copiers, they would put the assets on one side, the liabilities on the other side, and then the equity. And the two must balance. The income statement. We call this a cash flow statement in the 121 class, and when we do that, the accountants just cringe. They hate that. It's an income statement, you boo-boo. And we say, well, it's financial planning. What are we worried about? And then, because in the accounting world, a cash flow statement is something completely different. It used to be called the statement of cash flows. That tells us where the money goes. You know, what's going on with the money? Where is it moving from? So the balance sheet, as we said, we go from our assets, subtract our liabilities, and what's left over is equity. And so sometimes you'll see the formula written this way, assets equals liability plus equity, but most of us think of it this way, assets minus liability equals equity. Now, the accountants break the world up into short-term, current, they don't call it short-term, they call it current, and that means 1 year or less, and long-term. Anything greater than 1 year is long-term. We, in the finance world, investment world, we don't normally do that. We say, look, long, short-term is anyone for 1 to 2 years, long-term 5 to 7 years, and intermediate term somewhere in between. So let's take a look at the Ford balance. You ever hear of Ford? Sure you have, right, Ford? And you'll see that car companies, when the economy is doing well, they're doing great. They're making tons of money. And so far, you'll see that your assets have been growing steadily. Right? A bit of a jump here. I'm not sure why. But last year, they took a little bit of a hit. Car sales are down. You see, car sales are slowing around the world. Questions? Okay, no. And so we have our, they have 114, over 140, now that's not a million, that's, you have to add three zeros at the end. So $114.5 billion in current assets. Those are assets that are going to be used within the next year. But they also have a ton of long-term investments. So $256 billion in assets. Okay, let's take a look at the liabilities. Well, car companies typically have tremendous liabilities, and Ford is no different. They have $95.5 billion in, this is as of the end of last year, 2018, $95.5 billion in total current liabilities, stuff they have to pay within the next year, and then $100 billion in long-term debt, $24 billion other liabilities. So $220 billion in liabilities. You take the assets minus the liabilities, and they call that stockholders' equity. So $36 billion of that $256 billion is what is owned by Ford. Cool? Questions? Does that make sense? Yeah, now, of course, the more you dig into this, it's kind of like an onion. You peel back more and more layers. You pass that back that away, and you learn more about the inner workings of the balance sheet. Okay, now it's back to the income statement. The income statement, what we call in personal finance cash flow, is our income minus our expenses. So the difference between a company's revenue, and they usually use the word revenue, that's the top line. Did you, when you were listening to the earnings calls, the revenue is the top line number, whereas the net income, that's the bottom line number. So you might have heard that, top line growth, bottom line growth. So let's take a look at now. Okay, you know what? I should just copy that. Go back. Oh, by the way, have you looked at Rate My Professors? Check out Rate My Professors. It's kind of cute. I didn't want to look at first. I was like, no. My office mate. Yeah, go look at it. Okay, so now notice the top line revenue went up. See how it's been going up? Car sales have been doing really well. Ford makes a ton of money off that F-150 pickup truck, the most popular vehicle in the United States, North America. And so their gross profit has been going up. You take out the cost of revenue, cost of goods sold, that's how much it costs them to make the darn things. But then you also have to take out the overhead, sometimes called burdened operating expenses. Remember SG&A? SG&O, they just throw out these terms like you know what the hell you're talking about. No, you know. Sometimes you'll see selling, general, and operating, or overhead, selling, general, and administrative. So those are, you know, this is the lights and the rent and the bean counters and the advertising and that kind of stuff. This is how much it costs them to make the darn thing. So their operating income has actually gone down a little bit, hasn't it? They've had a little, see, it's been going down. And then there's all the other things, earnings before interest and taxes, income, interest expense, tax expense, and then they have their continuing operations. And then at the bottom, there's the non-recurring events. But there, we see that their last year, 2017, $7.6 billion they earned, and it's gone down about 30-40%. $3.6 billion, the bottom line number. Cool? Is that easy? Pretty straightforward? You just go like this, if you don't know what the, because we got some accountants in here, right? They can help us with this. And then the last one. Okay. But as we've said before, and we're going to go through, we're going to actually see some examples here. Some income, some expenses are not always received for or paid in cash. That's why the accountants have what's called a cash flow statement, or some of the people still call it the old name, the statement of cash flows. And so the cash flow, you know, is not necessarily what our earnings are. Sometimes we, in fact, we talked about this a couple weeks ago. Some companies are reporting record earnings during the huge run-up of buying equipment to have cell phones and internet, and yet the checkbook was going down, their cash was going down. Why is that? Well, this is what this statement is supposed to tell us. So let's say this guy over here. All right, so we have him, and then let's go to Ford's cash flow statement. So notice, the cash flow statement starts where the income statement ends. So it says, okay, how much did you tell the IRS you made? Right? You said you made $3.6 billion, almost $3.7 billion, but now what happened to your checkbook? And the biggest one often, in this case, except for these guys, which I don't really understand too well, some of you accounting folks can explain it to me, but the biggest one is depreciation. Because companies like Ford have to have huge upfront what are called capital expenditures, the IRS says, look, that's fine. You know, you're buying something that's you're going to use for the next 10, 20, 30 years. You can't expense the whole thing in 1 year. You have to depreciate it. And those of you in accounting who've done depreciation schedules know that you don't write a check out the depreciation. You know, you whatever, however you bought the device, if you paid cash or the plant or whatever, most of the time you finance it, you're going to be taking expenses from that over the next 30 years. But you don't write a check out to depreciation. So that $8.3 billion that they told the IRS we depreciated this year, they never wrote a check for that. So we add that money back into the pot. Does that make sense? That's why it's called a statement of cash flows. In other words, our checkbook did not go down that much. We didn't spend that much. But then there were some other adjustments. We had changes in accounts receivable, liabilities, inventories, capital expenditures. There's something they did write a check for. And then look at that. This one, I can't figure this out. I mean, I guess you have to, if you really, that's why I have Maria Martinez and Tanya Haddad. What's going on here? But they just said, oh, it washes out. They spent more money on investing activities than they pulled in. So they pulled in almost $52 billion in investing activities, but they spent $60 billion. So that's, the driverless cars that they're working on and all the new cars. They're always having new car development. And then here, they paid almost $3 billion in dividends. They bought back some of their shares. They borrowed $3 billion. And then there's some other cash flow. So what happened last year, 2018, is their checkbook actually went down $122 million. See that? That's the bottom line in this case. The year before that. So what has Ford been doing? They're not the only ones. They've been spending like crazy because within a few years they want to have driverless cars. And it just doesn't, you just don't pull it out of your hat. You got to spend billions of dollars to do it. So So what do you think? All right? Cool? Is this pretty straightforward? I think so. I'm sorry if we belabored the point a little bit. But I'm not the best accounting. Now, where does this information come from? All companies are required to make public disclosures of their material information fairly using a system called EDGAR. The Securities and Exchange Commission says, look, you've got to create your annual reports. What are those called? And what are the quarterly reports? And you know what I'm going to say, right? What are the quarterly reports?
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anyway, back in the late 90s when the internet was, you know, getting really exciting and people were doing things new and exciting, the SEC said, you know what? We want to have some kind of fair disclosure. Before this, analysts from Wall Street and from other investment organizations could go to presentations given by the companies, and the companies could release information to them that wasn't released to the public yet in the 10-Ks and 10-Qs. And the SEC says, that's not fair. So now, using the internet, they and some of you did the earnings call. If you haven't done it, please do it. Turn in your assignments. Without doing the assignments, it's kind of like learning how to drive without getting behind the wheel of a car. Now they say, okay, 9:30, you know, at the day, or maybe 9 o'clock, right before the market opens, New York time, or 4:15 after the market closes, we're going to have our earnings call. And at that time, these documents are put out on the internet so anybody can see them, and that's when the CEO and the CFO get up and online and talk about how wonderful they did or how wonderful they didn't do. So the earnings call is scheduled for the set date and time. And that's what you're going to use. Some of you have already done. If you haven't done it, please do it. Because sometimes it gets really boring. Did anybody really hate it? Did you listen to the whole thing? Or they go, the analyst goes, well, I'm Joe Blow from Somebody Securities. And we want to know what happens if it's a Tuesday and there's a tsunami and a meteorite hits your plant. I mean, what do you think? They just ask the stupidest question. I think they just want to hear themselves talk. And I've heard many people opine, complain, whatever, this is too much information. Do you get that feeling? Have you been doing some research, do you feel like it's a sip from the fire hose? Yeah, it is. And that's why, that's cool. You know, that's great because there's never an end to it. But at the same time, you get this unsettled feeling. You're like, have I gotten everything? Yeah, you're not going to get everything. You're only seeing the tip of the iceberg. And I love this guy, Nick Murray. He says it really well. Wisdom sold separately. Like that? You don't get the wisdom. So now, what we're going to do in chapter 17 is work with financial ratios. And a ratio, we've already done a few, dividend yield, price to earnings ratio. We've already done a few. We'll review the ones very quickly that we've gone through and then take a look at some new ones. And the ratio analysis is the study of the relationships between financial statement accounts, and that's what we're going to do. And as we said back in chapter 5, there's no one ratio that we can point at and say, ah, that's it! That's why I'm going to buy the stock, or that's why I'm going to sell the stock. I like to think of it as a stew that just sort of, you just look at everything and all the time start taking things in and then picking certain things out. And, of course, when you read in Intelligent Investor, you'll see how Mr. Graham does that. Plus, as we've said, you can't just look at one company without looking at their competitors, without looking at their suppliers and their vendors and their customers. So here are the common stock ratios. And all of these we've already gone through, except for the one, the PEG ratio. That's the only one we haven't gone through. But so we're going to run through these fairly quickly. But we use the balance sheet, we use the income statement, and these you can just look up because they're all online. So, do you remember PE, price-to-earnings ratio? Are you getting a feel for what it's like? Is it, you know, the end-all, the be-all? Even though it is the most popular, the one that's quoted the most, it's not the only thing you can look at. A high PE might not necessarily mean that the stock is that risky. A low PE might not necessarily mean that the stock is not that risky. 5 to 12, but now 14 to 20 is average. Greater than 20 was unusual, not anymore. Assuming nothing else changes, the PE gives you an idea how long it'll take back for the company to earn back its price. But that's not that important. I mean, people say, why is that important? Why is this the way to think about it? If you had a PE of 3, in 3 years, they will earn back the price of the company. They might not necessarily pay it out in dividends. The price might plummet. Who knows? The earnings might fall. You don't know. But that's just a way of thinking about it. So here are 6 different companies from various industries. And you heard of all these companies? Amgen Biotech. A big biotech company. Pfizer's a drug company. U.S. Bank, Facebook, ExxonMobil, General Mills. Oh, by the way, did you see in the news Kellogg's is selling off Keebler cookies? They're getting out of the cookie business. They're selling Famous Amos. You know, that's what some people think. Oh, yeah, I don't want to buy any of these corporate cookies. I'm going to buy Famous Amos owned by Kellogg's. My wife used to buy this stuff. Boca Burger. It's a soy burger, right? Oh, yeah. And I burst through a bubble. I said, it's owned by Philip Morris. Yeah, well, that was a long time ago. It's not owned. Philip Morris sold off all their food. Because they used to own Kraft. They used to own Nabisco. They used to own Post Cereal. They owned Miller Brewing.
Through, subsidiaries that have different names.
Yeah, right. Well, they post-serially, they go, oh, it's owned by a tobacco company. And why is that? Because they had all this cash. They had all this money. They didn't know what to do with it. And so they started buying things, and then they went, you know what? People won't buy our stock. They won't buy our stock, and then they won't buy Kraft. They won't buy post-serial. So, okay, let's sell it off. They sold it off. Okay, so now, is it fair to compare U.S. Bank with Facebook?
No.
Oh, by the way, did you see the Lyft went public? Oh, we didn't look. We didn't look at our... You heard of Lyft, right? We didn't look at our stocks. You guys are still doing almost 11%. You're cool. Where is he? Who wanted to buy a marijuana stock?
You're
going to
lose everything you made.
You think so? Most of it was made there. But no, you guys, Alibaba, Boeing, that's not bad. Intel, look at Qualcomm, it's $5.
Going down as fast as it went up.
No, it's fast, but it's going down. But there's marijuana stocks. But here, Lyft, where is it? Did I save it? Here. What did we say about initial public offerings? Yeah, they typically lose half their value within 1 year. So Lyft jumped. Oh wait, this is just today, but it's only been on. This is the second day, right? It jumped immediately, from where was it? I forget where they assigned it, but it jumped immediately, and now it started here. This was the IPO, and then jumped immediately, and then now it's lower than the initial public offering price.
I think it's
what? Buy it in a year. But, did you see the summary? Earnings. The stock price is $66 and they're losing $43. Now, obviously, that's probably, I mean, I don't know how it's obvious. I've never used an Uber or a Lyft, and I don't know that I will. Maybe I will. But, anyway, so that's enough of that. Okay, so, what do we have to do? We have to compare our individual potential choices with the industry that they're in. What do you think about banks? Are banks boring?
Yeah.
Is boring good? Yeah. For many of us, maybe it is. Some of you are like, nah, I don't like banks. But it used to be for decades that banks were boring, and that's what you wanted. And then in 1999, they repealed it's called Glass-Steagall, the law that separated banks from investment activities. In other words, you are a bank. You're making money because your doors are open, and we have federally charted you. You don't take those people's deposits and put them in risky assets. That was the idea. But that was fuddy-duddy. Oh, the Great Depression was 60 years ago. What are you worried about? It's a new era. It's financial deregulation. And don't worry, it's not just the Republicans. President Democrat Clinton, Democratic President Clinton, was the one who signed it. And sure enough, the banks got really exciting for about 8 years, 9 years. And then the whole thing crashed. So banks are boring again. But what about the internet stocks? Would you buy Netflix? No? Doesn't everybody use it now? Yeah? So other people are saying, yeah, I don't care. Amazon is taking over the world. I'll pay a huge price for my stock relative to the earnings because I believe they're going to grow those earnings. What about the oil companies? Fairly boring, right? Fairly boring, but very cyclical, very cyclical with the price of oil. And then what about the biotechs? So you see, does this tell you that you should buy Illumina or not buy Illumina? No, it's like a little red flag. I think I like to think of it like a little red flag saying, oh, something's weird here. Something's different than the others. Let's take a look at this in more detail. Are you with me? Understand? And maybe it is a good idea. Maybe it's not. I'm not too excited about buying something with a PE 55. Because if things don't go well, the parachutes had better be very large because it's a long way to fall. And then General Mills? Well, Kraft? Hormel? If I were the CEO of Hormel, I would have an email campaign. And I would say, this is spam! Because what does Hormel make? Spam. They're the company that makes spam. They make a bunch of other meat products, but they make spam. So I say, this is spam, and you're going to want it. We'll give you a free spam sandwich. But what about Heinz, Kraft Heinz?
It's not public.
It's public, but when you see not applicable, it means their earnings are negative because they don't want to show a negative PE. So, I don't know about Kraft Heinz. And then Pfizer, Bristol Myers, Merck, Eli. So investors are a whole lot more excited about the prospects of Merck and Eli Lilly than they are of Pfizer and Bristol Myers Squibb. Is that why you should buy it? Is that why you shouldn't buy it? It's just another piece of the puzzle, and it's another thing that says, look at me, you need to do more investigation. Cool? All right, so let's go through this, and then we're going to go through these very quickly, I hope. And if I go too fast, please slow me down. If I'm going too slow, then you can go like this and start playing with your phones, and I'll say, I'm going too slow. Okay, huh? Can we account for the wide PE disparity between different industries and different companies within industries? Well, again, it's our expectation of what's going to happen in the future, expectation of earnings, expectation of dividend. And this is from Jack Dreyfuss, who started a company called Dreyfuss Funds. It's now owned by the Bank of New York. And this is right out of A Random Walk Down Wall Street, which is one of the two books that you should read first, One Up on Wall Street or Random Walk Down Wall Street. And he wrote this back in the 1960s, right? The technologies were different at the time. That was when silicon, chips were out. But computers were still huge, and we didn't have microcomputers yet. Take a nice little company that's been making shoelaces for 40 years and sells at a respectable 6x earnings ratio. Change the name from Shoelaces Incorporated to Electronics and Silicon Firth Burners. In today's market, the words electronics and silicon are worth 15x earnings. However, the real play comes from the word Firth Burners, which nobody understands. A word that no one understands entitles you to double your score. Therefore, we have 6x earnings for the shoelace business, 15x earnings for the electronics and silicon, for a total of 21x earnings. Multiply this by 2 for Firth Burners, and we now have a score of 42x earnings. You see what he's saying here? But of course, these are old technologies. Now you replace it with cryptocurrency or marijuana or 3D printing, social diseases, networking, China, right, China. Ah, buy it. So you see, this happened a few years ago in San Diego. There's a company in San Diego, I'm not just going around, it's called Nanotech. And about 12, 13 years ago, the term nanotechnology started making it into news reports and the mainstream media. And the price of nanotech started to rise. And people were saying, why is nanotech's price rising? And I said, we don't know. You know, we're doing basically what we did before. They figured it was just because people looked at the, oh, nanotech, oh, we got to buy it. That's how people made the decision. And if you don't believe me, wait till next week. Okay, so now, the PEG ratio is one that we haven't discussed. And it's really not that exciting, in my humble opinion. The idea, the PEG ratio, is you take the PE ratio and divide it by the growth rate. And the idea is that the PE ratio should basically match the growth rate. If the company's growing at 15 times, you know, 15%, then we should have 15 times PE. If the company's growing at 30%, then the PE is 30. If the company's growing at 3%, then the PE is 3%. So if you then take the PE, let's say 20, and divide it by 15% growth rate, you get 1.5. So anything greater, if they're equal to 1, obviously, that means the growth rate is equal to the PE ratio. They're equal to one another. If 1 is higher, you'll have a number greater than 1. If the growth rate is higher, then you'll have a number less than 1. So in other words, anything above 1 was supposed to mean it was risky. You see that? You're just comparing the PE ratio with the growth rate, and they call it the PEG ratio. And you'll see, I think Yahoo shows it on their key stats. Let's take a look. Let's take a look at Yahoo. Okay, let's go to a company that is making money. And look at their key statistics, and I'm pretty sure. See, there's the PEG ratio. They're saying that their PE ratio is about 1.4 times their growth ratio. So their PE, whatever it is 16, and their growth is probably around 12% or so, 12, 13%. So that's what the PEG ratio. If you like it, great. I just look at the growth rate and the PE. I don't bother calculating the PEG ratio. Now, dividends per share, right? Take the annual dividends divided by number of shares outstanding. Do you have to calculate this? Do you have to calculate this? No, you look it up. It's there. If you want to, go right ahead. And we did. I think we did it once back in chapter 5, right? But just look it up because it's in right on the summary page. And dividends used to be taboo, passé, fuddy-duddy. Dividends don't lie, folks. So we love dividends. I love dividends. So you decide. And then dividend yield. You take the dividends per share divided by the market price. We did this in chapter 5. I asked you to do it on the assignment. But you just look it up. And as we said, 4 to 6% was considered good, but you don't see that often. Although some companies, we looked at the tobacco companies. Who owned British American Tobacco? Was that Jennifer? Yeah. Somebody did. Somebody in here owns British American Tobacco. They're paying 8%. But most companies, you know, 2%, 3% is typical. And as long as they're growing those earnings, that's pretty cool. And then the payout ratio, we did this in Chapter 5. Take the dividends per share divided by the earnings per share. More mature companies often pay out almost all or much of their earnings in the form of dividends. Why? They don't need the dividends. They don't need the earnings. They don't need to retain the earnings to grow the company. It's already grown, so they pay them out. But growing companies retain their earnings to support the growth of the company. And then book value per share, the equity divided by the number of shares outstanding. This is our net worth per share, if you will. How much assets are behind each share of stock. In other words, if all the assets of the company were liquidated, how much would each shareholder receive? It is common for the actual market price of a share to be way above the book value, because investors believe, and rightly so, if it's a good company, it's worth more intact than if you pieced it out and liquidated it. And far above. price to book value. Remember, price to the earnings, price to book value. Given that the book value per share is often less than the market price, the price to book value per share tells an investor how far above the book value the market value price is. So if you have a market price of 20 and a book value of 20, it would be 1. But is that what we normally have? No, we have a market price of 35 and a book value of 5. Let's take a look at them. Let's take a look at ExxonMobil real fast. So what's the book value per share? Where is it? $45. What's the price of Exxon? 81. So investors believe that Exxon is worth a whole lot more intact than if we sold off all the assets, paid off the debts, and walked away. Cool. I'm sorry if I'm going through this very quickly, because this is a review. And then price to cash flow. Same idea as price to earnings, but this time we use cash flow, and we talked about why when we discussed the financial statements. Sometimes we have good quality earnings, sometimes we have poor quality earnings, because some earnings are not paid out in cash, and we saw the depreciation is one of them, but there were many on the statement of cash flows. And we talked about Lucent Technologies. Lucent builds the best telephone equipment in the world. Companies were buying their stuff like crazy, but didn't have any cash. The companies, no bank would touch them. They couldn't sell stock. So they were saying to Lucent, hey, we'll pay you. You be the bank. We'll pay you the $2 billion over the next 30 years. And then 2 years later, they're out of business. So Lucent never really got those earnings, did they? They never really were able to. They had to write down those earnings. And then this is the last one, right? And then price to sales. Same idea as price to earnings, price to cash flow. But instead of using earnings or cash flow, we use sales per share. A higher sales growth, lower sales growth. But many analysts were using price to sales instead of price earnings, because there are never going to be any earnings. Not for 5-10 years. Oh boy, great. It's a great company. Let's buy it. So these are all review. Okay, now we're ready. How are we doing for time? Okay, now we're ready to take a look at ones that we haven't looked at. So on your handout is a second page are the financial ratios. And we've gone through the first one, the common stock ratios. And those you just look up, right? The next groups, profitability, liquidity, activity, leverage, many of those you can look up, but several of them you can do your own. You calculate on your own. And we're going to use 4. So let's go through, at least, how are we doing? Not bad. We should actually get through. Get through at least the first group, profitability ratios. Okay. The profitability ratios are ratios that measure a firm's returns by relating profits to sales, profits to assets, profits to equity. And so these are the ones we're going to take a look at. They allow us to measure the ability of a firm to earn an adequate return on sales, total assets, and invested capital. So let's take a look at the first one, the net profit margin. Remember, the net profit is the bottom line number that the CEOs and the CFOs love to talk about. So I've never heard it called after-tax profit margin, maybe once or twice. But most people say, what's the net profit? The role of profit being earned from earnings after expenses and taxes. So you take the net income divided by the total revenue. The top line number. So let's do net profit margin. Okay, so net income divided by total revenue. This is on what statement? Net income, total revenue? It says if you look on the the formula tells you. Yeah, but income statement, right. So if you go to your Ford, where's Ford? Hello, Ford. Here it is, right. There's the balance sheet. Put that there. So if we go to the Ford, if we go to the Ford income statement, what's our net profit? What's our net profit? Tough question. You don't have to use the last three zeros. Just, what's the net profit? Everyone should say 3682. Wait till I ask you, what's the net profit? Three. You can do it. You can do point. Yeah, as long as you do it. As long as you do it on the other one too. But that's a comma. But if you want to put 3.682, that'll work. But just make sure you do it in the bottom. All right. And then what's the top line number? What is our total revenue? 160 point. If you want to use point, that's fine. 163.40. So take it. You get your calculators. 3682. Well, it's up to you. You can leave it as however your count. What does your calculator say?
0.023.
Or you can write 2.23%, because it's often shown as a percentage. Okay, so where is it here? So I know Yahoo has this one. So here it is. They call it the profit margin here. There it is there. Now notice it's a little different, and I don't understand why. And this is something. These are the prompts. What?
It's 0.0229.
229. What did you guys get? 2.23.
9.
Oh, 9. I'm sorry. Oh, sorry. That's perfect. Sometimes it's all a little off. Sometimes a little off. But there. So sometimes what you'll see is TTM. Which stands here. This is most recent quarter. It's MRQ. TTM stands for trailing 12 months. And here they don't do that because I'm sure they're using the last year. But sometimes they just use the last 12 months. They go back 12 months, not the previous year. Cool? Now, is that good? Is 2.29% good for Ford? I don't know. What do we have to do? We're looking at Ford. We got to go look at GM, right? We got to go look at Honda and Toyota and all the other companies that are involved in that industry. You can't just look at the one company and say, oh, that's horrible. That's probably pretty darn good for us. If you go back and look at the other car companies, you'll probably say, oh, Ford's not doing so bad. But that's the issue, right? And then when you see somebody say, wait a minute. How come there's 10%? You know, what's going on with them? What's going on with them? You know, it might be a high-end company that doesn't sell as many cars. So this is where many people think Tesla went wrong. Tesla was just the Mercedes-Benz and BMWs. The Lexus, they caught flat-footed. How could this company just? I don't know if you drive around Point Loma or La Jolla. Do you see a lot of Teslas? I see him in San Ysidro. Like, okay, you know, congrats. I'm not trying to make a bad thing about San Ysidro, but these cars are not cheap, right? And yet, Mr. Musk, was determined to make one that he said was for the masses. Now, again, $35,000, is that for the masses? And that's not even available yet. If you go in there and ask for the $35,000, they'll say, oh, look at this one for $56,000. Oh, look at this one for $70,000.
The technology is good.
But still.
And don't they pretty much have a buyer before they even make the car?
Well, they have plenty of demand. Yes, they haven't even made the $35,000 car, and there's, I don't know how many, tens of thousands of people waiting to buy it.
Like, they don't have like a whole, you won't see a huge car lot of Teslas.
Well, you do when they can't get them out the door. they're having a problem right now distributing them. They're stacking up in these fields because they can't they're asking their employees to drive them to the customers. The guy's insane, but you know, he's doing it. Let's see. What does he say? He says it's nuts. He says it's crazy. Yeah, I can imagine. Here you go. Okay. What am I doing? Don't worry about it. Just watch what he does. I know. That's why.
He worked at a factory that produced the battery.
Oh, that's he was in.
The battery
that produced the machines, but when the machines mess up,
his job like. I thought
another machine comes out and fixes it. No. Okay, no. So the gross margin. So that was in by Sparks Reno by Reno. It's in Nevada.
Facility?
Near the Bay. Oh, it's near the Bay. Okay. Yeah. Okay, so the gross margin takes the gross profit. Ew, gross. No, not that kind of gross. Gross profit and divides it by total revenue. So there's that same top line number, but where is the gross profit? Where is the gross profit? Let's go to the income statement. And where did it go? What's the gross profit? Can you see that? Is it too small? Make it bigger. What's the gross profit? 22,760. So that's after taking out the cost of goods sold and then dividing it by that same top line number. And what's that, about a little over 10%? No, yeah.
It's on the first page or page 3?
It's on the income statement. What page is that, 3? No, page 4. Income statement, page 4. Right, sorry. Page 4, income statement. 0.1. Right?
Well, multiply by 100.
Yeah. Okay. 14.19 or 14.19% or 14. Three digits is usually good. 14.2%. But 14. Yeah. So 14%. Yeah, because we're not including all the other expenses. We're just looking at how much it cost them to build the darn things. And so that's looking a whole lot better. But again, we need to compare it to their competitors. Okay, how are we doing? Let's continue. And then the operating margin, the same idea, except in this case we're going to use the operating income, sometimes called operating profit. So the operating margin takes the operating income and divides it by the top line number, again, the total revenue. Is this hard? No, it's actually very, very straightforward. So let's go back to the, okay, so the operating income was 3184. 3184 divided by that top line number. And again, we get like 3% or something. 2%. 0.0. Come on. You guys got the calculators.
198?
Yeah. 1985. 1985. So 1.99%. Almost 2%. About 2%. And again, we compare that with our competitors. Higher the better, and it varies greatly from industry to industry. So we're looking at a specific company. We always need to look at its competitors within the industry. You think that a software company would have the same kind of numbers? How much does it cost to build the software, right? Especially after it's already done, they keep redoing it. When we find a company that is atypical of its competitors in industry, it is a signal that we need to do more investigative work. Okay. Now, the next two, return on assets and return on equity, are relating our income to items that are on the balance sheet. These two, these three, related it to the revenue. Now we're relating it to our assets or our equity. So return equity and return on assets and its cousin, next one, return on equity, take that same net income, the bottom line, and then compare it to how much assets it took us to build, to make that much money. All right? So the net income is still 3682, but where is the total assets located? Where is the number for the total assets? That's on the balance sheet. So what are the total assets for Ford? These are tough questions, folks. Somebody in the cheap seats? Go to the intern. Thank you. 256 540. And what do we get? Again, a very small number. 0.01 1.44%. And this is typical of car companies. Why? Because they need a tremendous amount of assets to build those cars. It's not software. It's not candy bars. Cars are huge capital and expenditures. So you'll see numbers very similar to this and the other competitors. And then, okay, return on assets looks at the amount of resources a company needs to support operations. It reveals how effective the company is in generating profits from the assets it has available. The higher, the better. It's very popular, along with return on equity, sometimes called a return on investment, ROI. Now, we're going to just look at how much of the company we own, the equity portion of the company. So it's the same net income, but now we're going to divide it by the stockholders' equity, or just sometimes called equity, stockholders' equity, net stockholders' equity. Equity, I can't spell. All right, so that same 3682, but now we go to the balance sheet, and how much of the company does Ford actually own, as opposed to how much debt is on the debt on the balance sheet? How much do we own? 36070. And we're going to see that number is a whole lot bigger than the return on assets. What do we get now? 10.2%. Either way, you don't have to turn it into a percentage. You can leave whatever your calculator says. So why is that? Well, what's going on? It's Ford is using a whole lot of other people's money to make their money. They have a tremendous amount of debt on the books, as we say. So let's read. Because return on equity uses stockholders' equity instead of the total assets for the denominator, the return on equity is sensitive to the amount of debt a company is carrying. Specifically, if a company carries a great amount of debt, the return on equity will be much larger than return on assets. You are using other people's money to make your money. Have you heard that term? You'll probably hear it a lot in real estate, right? It's called leverage. You're going to hear that term a few times throughout the rest of the semester here. Some investors think this is good. You know, cool, you're using other people's money to make your money. You're leveraging their money to help you. But what's the downside? If you can't make your interest payments, what happens? You're bankrupt, right? They haul you into bankruptcy court. So it's a dual-edged sword. It can help you, but that can kill you, too. He's in jail now, isn't he? Yeah.
Every single time, he'll get all these investors and talk up all his companies. His very first venture was supposed to be a black card for young adults and everything. So he'd promise front row seats to Beyonce or tickets to the Met Gala. But he'd never got them.
Oh, they never got them in his first ventures.
Yeah, and so he would he would never have the tickets. So he'd sell more tickets that he didn't have to buy the tickets that he needed to give out, the night of. And it was just...
It's called a Ponzi scheme.
And he would do it over and over again.
And got away with it until...
Until Fire Festival. And then so he was on probation or something like that. And then did it again. using the emails that he collected from Fire Festival, but now he hired some other guy, so his name wasn't on it, but they were associated, so.
And so now they're both in jail.
No, well, the other guy's not.
The other guy's not in jail?
Billy McFarland is.
But the other guy's going to be in jail
soon.
He's
still running his scheme for him.
And what did P.T. Barnum say over 100 years ago? There's a sucker born every minute. you'd think you'd figure it out. Oh no, I'm gonna go. What happened? They got cheese sandwiches, right, when they got there. That's what they had for them. They said they're gonna have all this champagne and caviar and all this food, and they got a soggy tent and cheese sandwiches. Did anybody go to the Fire Festival? And how much did they want to go? It was really outrageous.
$15,000 a ticket for the most basic like camping experience.
And you get cheese sandwiches. Cool. Okay. All right. So what do you think? What do you think? Want to keep going? Got one more to do or so? Is this pretty straightforward? Yeah. This is boring. Okay. So. why don't we do this? For Thursday, you guys, on your own, can go through the liquidity ratios. Let's do the liquidity ratios, because they're actually very important. And then you can do the others on your own. And then we'll compare notes when we get back on Thursday. Because they're not that hard. Once you've seen one... Oh, where's this? You're supposed to say, you've seen them all. Okay, but now, these two ratios, the current ratio and the asset test ratio, are ones that often investors will look at because they are concerned with the firm's ability to meet their day-to-day operating expenses. Because if you can't make payroll, if you can't pay your interest payments, you've got serious problems. So the two ratios are the current ratio and the acid test ratio. What a great name, right? And then this other guy really isn't a ratio. He's sort of the one outlier in this group. So the current ratio is the current assets divided by the current liabilities. And if you remember... The accountants call current anything that is going to be utilized within a year. So if we go back to the balance sheet, and that's where this says on the balance sheet. Come on, balance sheet, got away. We take a look at Ford's current assets. You know, only $17 billion in cash, $17 billion in short-term investments, which are like cash. People owe them $66 billion. They've got $11 billion of inventory and then $3.5 billion of other assets. So that's $114,650. Wow, $114 billion you're going to get within a year. But you compare that to their current liabilities, and they've got it to pay $21.5 billion. They've got to pay almost $54 billion of long-term debt that's coming due, and then another $20.5 billion. So they've got $95,570,000 in current liabilities. Well, divide those two, and if that number is one or greater, then their current assets and their current liabilities are satisfied. If it's greater than one, then they have more assets than they have current liabilities. Is Ford doing okay?
Yes.
1.511? What was it?
1.2.
So they have 1.2 times the current assets than the current liabilities. Is Ford in danger of being thrown into bankruptcy court? No. We're going to take a look at another one, too, the times interest earns. Now, the asset test ratio is very similar. Let's skip the net working capital and come back to that on Thursday. But the asset test ratio is basically the same thing, but it's more stringent. Why? Because it throws out the inventory. it says, look, that inventory may or may not be available for sale. It might go bad. It might be perishable. Or it might become obsolete. Do cars become obsolete? Last year's models? Do you throw them away? What about if you're a computer company? Wrong. That's why Dell was the first one to do this, but all the other companies do it now. They don't build the darn things until they get an order. They would develop them and they would start marketing them, but then they would build them until they got an order. And they started this whole thing about just-in-time inventory, and some of you might have learned about that in your accounting classes and management classes. So this one you could calculate two different ways, and I like the second way because I think it's a whole lot easier. You take the current assets and just subtract out the inventory. So let's do that. Let's go take a look at the... Okay. What are the current assets again? Right. And then subtract out the inventory. Oops. And then you divide that by the current liabilities. You can add up the others, it's up to you. But 114, 650, and then how much inventory do they have? 11,220. And then you divide that again by 95,570. So 114 minus 11,220, it's 10. What is that? Careful number of digits. 114, 650. So you guys got the calculators. Well, you gave me the whole answer. Okay. 1.08 is the answer. So, yes, they still have more than one. But even if you threw out all their inventory, which in Ford's case is not going to become obsolete, they're still going to be able to sell it. They're going to have to, you know, discount a little bit because it's last year's models. But so what was 114, 650 minus 11, 620?
430.
And then divide that by 95,570. Okay. 108. Cool? All right, so when we come back, you guys do the rest of them on your own if you want. And we'll go through these very quickly. And then we can start the silliness of chapters 7 and 8. Thank you so much for sticking around with us, folks. I know it's disparaging to look around. It's discouraging to see students just disappearing, but that's part of it. You know, what can I say? And if you have anything to turn in, please turn them in now. Turn them in now. Okay, well done. What a great class.